a new risk score for patients who are admitted to the hospital with COVID-19.
Preventing COVID transmission in overnight camps.
What is the impact of bisphenol A on people's health?
And trends in blood pressure control in adults with high blood pressure.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, why don't we mix it up just a little bit and turn first to the Journal of the American Medical Association. This look at high blood pressure, clearly something that's been identified as a risk factor for COVID-19. And what are the trends in management for about 10 years of data?
I know it seems like we talk a lot about high blood pressure over the, 18 years we've been doing the podcast. But actually, there are more cardiovascular events in the U.S. attributed to hypertension than any other modifiable risk factor. Worldwide, there are over 874 million people that have high blood pressure. What we know is when we began to focus on high blood pressure, that the proportion of U.S. adults with hypertension who became aware of it and had controlled hypertension improved from the mid-1980s and 1990s to the early 2000s. Well, in fact, from 1998 to 2009. But the real question is, what's been happening over the last decade? Because there's been some concern that the control and the awareness of it really hasn't been quite as good. They looked at over 51,000 participants in the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey data. Of those, about 18,000 had high blood pressure. Blood pressure control increased from 32% in late 1990s to as much as 54% in 2013-2014. Unfortunately, what's happened over the last 5 to 6 years is that blood pressure awareness and control has declined. It's declined from 54% down to 44%. And there are certain groups in which the blood pressure control was worse. Those over age 75, blacks, those without health insurance, and those who had not had a health care visit in the past year, and only 8% had controlled blood pressure.
I guess I'm finding this a little bit inexplicable because in the midst of all this, we've had Obamacare and many more people enrolled in health insurance. And so I'm struggling to really try to account for why awareness would have declined over that time.
Sometimes we just get blasé about things, especially if we don't realize the importance. That's number one. Number two, especially in the older population, we have the Joint National Committee 7 and 8. Those are two different time spans. 7 recommended tight control of blood pressure in the elderly. 8 said, well, we're not so sure it needs to be quite so good. As long as we get it below 140 over 90, we're doing okay. But actually, what the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology recommended after that was, no, we need to have more rigorous blood pressure control, especially in the elderly. And there were some people that predicted when the JNC8 recommendations came out is that we would have relaxed blood pressure control. It wouldn't be quite as good. In fact, it looks like the statistics bear that out.
Well, clearly, we have talked before about elderly folks and whether it needs to be that tightly controlled. And we have had conflicting data relative to it. And I'm just wondering if we need more data that clearly establishes, oops, if you aren't controlling your blood pressure as you age, you're going to be at higher risk for these other outcomes.
Well, it probably doesn't need to be in the 100 to 110 range, but it should clearly be below 140. At the same time, avoiding hypotension and the consequences of that.
Since we're talking about risk factors, let's turn to the British Medical Journal. We know, of course, hypertension is a risk factor for more severe COVID-19 disease. This study takes a look at if you're admitted to the hospital with COVID-19, how can we stratify your risk for a dire outcome while you're there? They developed something that they're calling the 4C mortality score. First of all, I have to comment that people should take a look at this paper just to look at the sheer number of authors who are cited in this paper. Literally, it goes on for 2 pages. It's remarkable. They had over 35,000 patients who were included in what they call the derivation data set. And then they had a validations data set of over 22,000 patients, all of whom were admitted to the hospital with COVID-19. They had 8 variables that were readily available when they were initially brought into the hospital: age, sex, number of comorbidities, respiratory rate, peripheral oxygen saturation, level of consciousness, urea level, and C-reactive protein score. when they assessed all of those factors and they put them together, they ended up with a score that could predict this is how likely you are to die. They cited, of course, that most patients with severe COVID-19 have a clinical picture that everybody, I think, is pretty familiar with right now. Pneumonitis, profound hypoxia, systemic inflammation that affects multiple organs. And their aim was to develop a pragmatic and clinically relevant risk stratification score, because the ones that have been developed so far, they think, are not really very good. So when they took a look at all of these folks, their median age of the patients in their cohort was 73 years. 41, almost 42% of them were female. The majority, 76%, had at least one comorbidity. So again, sort of not surprising. This model actually turned out to be really good at predicting. They had four risk groups that were defined with corresponding mortality rates. Low risk was 0 to 3 and a mortality rate of 1.2%. Intermediate risk score, 4 to 8, 9.9%. High risk, 9 to 14, was 31.4%. And very high risk, greater than or equal to 15, 61.5, almost 62% mortality. The data, especially when it's presented in a graphic fashion, show this very linear relationship, and it's pretty compelling. One of my questions about this study was, I didn't see where they employed this clinically to affect their decision making.
And by the way, the 4C refers not to the score, but to the fact it's called the Coronavirus Clinical Characterization Consortium. What they did is they derived the score with one cohort and then validated it with the next subsequent cohort. So how could you use this? Well, all of these characteristics that they gleaned were things you gain when the person first presents to the hospital. That is the emergency department. So you don't have to wait long for those things. If their risk score is low, that is their risk of death is going to be 1.2%, those patients can probably be cared for at home. If you know the risk is going to be very high, that is, there's a 70% chance of risk, and those people need to get admitted to the hospital and probably to the intensive care unit. Now, the next step is, can you lower the mortality based upon this risk score? And we don't know that, but I think it can drive the hospitalization. There were a couple of things they didn't measure. We've said before that a low lymphocyte count and a high lactate dehydrogenase level, LDH, also predicts who's going to do poorly. Unfortunately, they didn't measure that in most of these patients, so they didn't include that in their model. But the things they did include are easily obtainable when the person first presents on admission to the hospital.
Well, clearly the follow-up for this is going to be, let's see it in action. Let's see how it does predict who ends up having to go to the ICU, who could be on the floor, who needs high-flow nasal cannula, and all the rest of the things that people are making decisions about when someone's admitted. Let's turn to your next one. That's in Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. A while ago, we talked about a camp in Georgia where they had a really bad outcome with regard to the transmission of COVID-19. In this case, much better outcome.
Right. This is kind of interesting, and I didn't realize the magnitude of the changes that occurred with COVID. For example, shortly after we declared the pandemic in the U.S., 124,000 public and private schools were affected, and that's 55.1 million students during the school year. There are almost 9,000 U.S. overnight camps, and about 82% of them didn't operate because of the COVID. Now, apropos to what happened in Georgia, where a significant number of campers and staff caught the COVID infection. What they did in Maine was they took a very different approach. There were four overnight camps that had combined over 1,022 attendees. They said, what can we do to potentially make this safe? And they did pre-arrival quarantine. People had to be quarantined for 14 days. They had testing done before they arrived at camp and then after they arrived at camp. They did symptom screening. They cohorted the campers into small groups. They required use of face coverings, physical distancing. They had enhanced hygiene measures, and they did most of their outdoor programming. So when they did that, of these campers, they came from 41 different states and some from different countries. And during the time in camp, only 0.3% of the staff and campers tested. They were asymptomatic, and they isolated them, and there was no other secondary spread. What this tells me is that if you're pretty fastidious about things, you can run an overnight camp with over 1,000 people from 41 different states and do it safely. And by the way, these people stayed at camp between 44 and 62 days. They did it right.
Well, I think it's really great that we can demonstrate that these kinds of things can be done. How practical would you say these measures are for promulgation to other settings, like schools, for example?
Well, Elizabeth, the major issue is not do the measures work, it's whether people adhere to them. In this particular study, if you were a camper and they demanded testing beforehand and you didn't have testing done, you came to camp, they isolated you until your test results were available. So if everybody bought into it, students and teachers, and most importantly, the parents, and we did these things, we could make any type of activity much safer.
Well, that is an important thing, and I really hope that that's actually how the whole thing turns out. Let's turn to the final one that we're going to talk about. Something that emerging, at least for me as a public health risk, is this idea of bisphenol A exposure. And in this case, in JAMA Network Open, a look at all-cause and cause-specific mortality in U.S. adults. Bisphenol A is ubiquitous. The stuff is everywhere. It's a chemical that's used for lots of different things. And one of the things that particularly I pay attention to, because every time I get a receipt, I don't want it all over my fingertips, is thermal printed receipts actually use this. It's also found in all kinds of plastics and epoxy resins, and those are used in water pipes, inside of food and beverage cans, as I said, those thermal papers that give us sales receipts almost always. And BPA has endocrine disrupting effects. Other studies in animals have shown that it also impacts on obesity and metabolic disorders, cardiac arrhythmias, it may accelerate atherosclerosis, decrease atrial contraction rate and force, and lead to cardiac remodeling. So, could be related to obesity, diabetes, hypertension, and cardiovascular disease, all of which are increasing in our population. So this is a cohort study that had 3,800 plus adults aged 20 years and older, about half of whom were women, and during a median follow-up of 9.6 years with a maximum of 13 years, they had 344 deaths, including 71 from cardiovascular disease and 75 from cancer. They did see that there was a relationship between higher urinary bisphenol A levels and higher risk for death. And they adjusted for age, sex, race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, dietary and lifestyle factors. I think this is just one more piece of data that says this is something that we need to be concerned about.
As you've noted, it's an association. It doesn't prove causality, but obviously there is some concern because there's some biologic plausibility in animal studies. As you said, exposure to BPA is pretty ubiquitous. It affects more than 90% of the general U.S. population. In fact, for the samples they obtained, the urine samples, 96% of them has some BPA detectable. Here's a couple of the issues. Even though it increased all-cause mortality, most of us thought it increased the risk of cancer, but it actually didn't increase the risk of cancer at all. There was some thought that maybe it increased cardiovascular mortality, and it did, but it wasn't statistically significant. So what we don't have yet is what is the cause for the increase in all-cause mortality. And as you know, BPA's use has been decreasing and exposure in the population has been decreasing. And some of it's been replaced by bisphenol F and bisphenol S. And the question is, do they also have toxic side effects? And we don't really know the answer to that either.
No, but I think it's definitely an environmental factor that is worth paying attention to, especially if it can be modified.
And it certainly warrants further investigation. And we need to see if we can replicate these findings in other populations. And more importantly, if we can determine the underlying mechanism.
Very good. On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lighty. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.